This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four.
Episode 8, 1961, Part 1.
How old were you when you started at Marvel, Roy?
Well, I'm informed by people in the industry I was an old man because I was pushing 25, and almost everybody else, yourself included, that I know, got in when they were teenagers.
Yeah.
But in the middle 60s, almost nobody had been getting into the field for several years, so at 24, I guess I was fairly young.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. When you started, I have to put these on so I can see my security blanket here, okay? When you started, you looked so young because you were, as I remember, you were so innocent-eyed and so believing and trustful and everything.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah, oh, you changed. But anyhow, yeah, I remember, and you were absolutely a godsend to me because I was looking so desperately for somebody who could handle all these books and do this writing and so forth, and it just was as though you were the answer to a prayer. Remember, you took over the Fantastic Four, you took over the Avengers, the X. I guess you did almost all the stories.
Most.
And as good as anybody could have wanted, built up your own following. I began to hate you as the fans began to love you. But here we are.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to the Marvel Age podcast. My name, of course, is Nick Duke. I come to you on bright and early, a little bit unusual for us, you know, not to tell you how the sausage is made, but normally these are nighttime recordings where we've all been awake and very rambunctious, and here I am on a Monday morning after a football weekend, no longer hungover, but still not quite to my normal self, so I apologize in advance for any lack of enthusiasm or just lack of a general state of giving a fuck that I may give during the course of this episode. But yeah, my name's Nick Duke. With me, as always, are the Sarctic Four, beginning with the West Coast Connection, the manager himself, Mr. Todd Weber. Todd, how are you bright and early in your part of the world?
Yes, this may be setting a record for how early I can work for these podcasts. I even have a job. My day job does not usually start this early, so this is interesting. Thank you for having me continue to be a part of the Sarcastic Four.
Well, we couldn't do it without you, sir. Also joining us back here in the southeastern part of the country, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you this morning / afternoon / whatever time of day it is we want to call this?
You know, I'm the only one of us who's day drinking right now, so I'm doing pretty well. It's a good way to start off a Monday morning off recording this, of course, on Labor Day. So we're actually putting in a little bit of work to bring the people some entertaining stuff all about those 1960s Marvel comics that we love so good.
Absolutely. And I'm gonna be honest with you. When you said the words day drinking, my stomach turned a little bit, but that's okay. Also joining us, someone who is also not drinking, so I join him in sobriety and solidarity, Mr. Tim Capel. Tim, how are you on this fine Labor Day morning / early afternoon?
Yes, well, Monday mornings typically are an insufferable, unspeakable blot on the escutcheon of humanity. Mm-hmm. But it is a holiday weekend, and I trust that the task before us will not be too laborious.
We won't get to anything insufferable until we get to Nick Fury later in the show. And so we start this episode, as we do every episode when we're entering a new year in Marvel Comics, as we are this episode, which I should have said earlier to tell you what exactly it is you're listening to, but there it is with my general lack of preparedness and enthusiasm today. We are going to be talking 1967 in Marvel Comics. As you know, if you've listened to the last few episodes, we've been taking each episode or each year and splitting it into multiple episodes. So this is going to be part one of 1967. And just so you know off the top, today we're going to be covering Fantastic Four 57 through 60, 62 through 63, 65, and Annual 5, as well as Strange Tales 153 through 155 and 157 through 158. Why are those random single issues skipped throughout those lists? I don't know. We didn't make those.
I don't know.
The great comic book herald, Dave Busing, made these lists. Go over to comicbookherald.com. Find all his reading lists if you're a newcomer to comics or if you just want to get caught up on some stuff you may have a little bit of a blind spot for. All kinds of resources for both your Marvel and DC reading needs. And if you feel so inclined, you know, kick a couple bucks to the Patreon account so he can keep that site open and keep bringing us lots of good content. But That's neither here nor there. So, guys, let's start this this year discussion of 1967 the same way we have before, kind of just talking generally about what we were expecting out of this year. And I'll start. I didn't really know what to expect out of this year. I knew it was going to be something of a change because over on Strange Tales, we're going to see Jim Steranko start to come into his own. On Nick Fury, you know, kind of see Jack start to step back from that character. We're going to see, you know, Steve Ditko is fully gone from both, Doctor Strange and Spider-Man by this point. So artistically, those series are going to continue to shift, as well as narratively, seeing, you know, the heavy hand he had in scripting or plotting both of those as well. So it's just going to be a year of change, I feel, in the Marvel Universe, at least creatively. So, yeah, looking forward to diving into this one. Tim, what were you looking for out of 67 as we begin this journey?
I was looking forward to watching the Marvel superheroes on TV, which is emblazoned across several pages of the issues we covered here. And that's like the – was that the Gantry Lawrence? It was like kind of a shitty Fumetti almost animation style.
Like they moved the cutout paper across the screen, and then they also had Fantastic Four, they had Namor, they had Spider-Man, but it was a different production house for Spider-Man. Hulk, Iron Man,
had some Cap in there. But yeah, kidding aside, I think what I was looking for going into 67 was some new blood. Far be it for me to suggest that the Stan, Jack, and Steve show maybe getting a little, I'm not going to say old, but we get it. We've covered a lot of comic up to this point, and principally the creators on those comics have been some combination of that trio. So now we're getting to see some new artists, which really I would say started in the last year that we covered. But Stan, kind of handing the reins off, trusting some other people with his duties as well. So, I'm not going to call it so much a year of transition necessarily, just because we haven't taken the year as a whole quite yet. But we will see. We definitely get some new voices, some new creative voices on these characters.
Absolutely. Russell, what were you expecting out of 67 as we you know, start the year?
Well, we've noticed an uptick in quality on Fantastic Four. So that's something that I was looking to hopefully see if it continued, because as listeners know, I got way more into the story in 1966 than I ever expected I would, and that was kind of a continuing trend. So I was hoping that would continue on as has already been mentioned. Jim Steranko was coming on to Nick Fury. So that's going to be hopefully fingers crossed, a big improvement on that book. We'll see, certainly. And there was some changes coming up for Doctor Strange too, because as we mentioned on our previous episode, Steve Ditko is no longer the artist on Amazing Spider-Man or on Doctor Strange. Two titles that he was not just the artist for, but probably the primary creative driving force on. So we've already seen changes happening on Amazing Spider-Man, but this is going to be our first look at what Doctor Strange is going to be like without Steve Ditko. So, you know, I have that tepid expectations, trying to, you know, not be too overly worried about a change, but also at the same time wondering what's this going to be like, since those are the two books that have kind of really hit biggest with, I think, collectively with this group up to now. So this is going to be our first taste of, as Tim alluded to, that new blood coming in. What is it going to be like? So I'm in wait and see mode.
Gotcha. Todd, what about you?
Well, Tim and Russell and you covered a lot of what I was going to say. You know, the influx of new creators, the second wave of Marvel creators and seeing what they do. But over half the year, or it feels like over half the year of what we're reading in this, is just Stan and Jack again. So looking Fantastic Four specifically, how do they integrate the new characters, specifically Silver Surfer, into this book? And we're enjoying reading these, but it makes me really want to see, oh, well, what would this creator do in another book, such as Romita Sr. In Spider-Man, or Marie Severin coming on to Doctor Strange, Jim Steranko coming on to Strange Tales, Nick Fury. So both the new characters introduced and this new wave of creators. We had Denny O'Neill come in 66, but we don't see a lot of him so far in 67. But there are some other writers who we will talk about soon.
Yeah, it's still kind of stand, but like you guys said, you know, it is starting to sort of make that move to more of an actual bullpen of writers. So going to be interesting in the years ahead.
And even when it's not Stan writing, he's still getting top billing as the editor. So Stan's still bringing you this story, and he's still the selling point as a creator to the readers, but he may not necessarily be writing it.
Yeah. Well, guys, let's jump right in, and let's start this discussion of 1967 with the first family of Marvel, those, of course, being the Fantastic Four. And we're going to start here with a four-part story involving Dr. Doom taking the power cosmic of the Silver Surfer and using it to, you know, essentially set out on a quest for world domination. Russell kind of talked about this a little bit in our 66 discussion of Fantastic Four with the Galactus trilogy that, you know, neither of us have ever been huge Fantastic Four fans. And it wasn't the Galactus trilogy that so much got me to this point, but this Doctor Doom story got me to the point where I can say, I get it now. I get what it is about the Fantastic Four that made them what they were at this point in comics history. I thought this would be up there for me with anything else we've read, whether it's the long-form Steve Ditko Doctor Strange stuff, whether it's some of the high points of Amazing Spider-Man. This four-part Doom and Silver Surfer story is every bit as good as any Marvel comic we've read since we started this podcast, in my opinion. I loved it.
Probably the best Fantastic Four story we've read up to this point. I think it is. Even to me, as far as a multi-issue arc, I still like This Man, This Monster. I still like the very, very first Galactus issue where you don't know what's coming. It's that big reveal, the tension. But this one has all the tools in the toolbox, all the toys in the toy box. There we go. And uses them. You see these characters like Silver Surfer, who Stan's favorite character. We've heard him say it. Be portrayed as this person who loves humanity, this individual with great power, and he trusts humanity so much, and Dr. Doom sticks a knife in his back, and it's beautiful to see. We also kind of get a foreshadow. This reminded me a little bit of the classic Secret Wars story where Dr. Doom steals the Beyonder's power in a similar way. Maybe not exactly the same way, but it reminded me enough of it that I got kind of the deja vu feeling. Classic Kirby art throughout. I mean, fantastic layouts and future tech and all the stuff that we love Kirby for, you know, his single page things. You get to see these huge techno structures that he gets to draw. He just cuts loose. The Joe Sinnott inks are my favorite on Kirby. We get the Inhumans, and they don't even ruin this story, you know?
No.
This is such a good story, the Inhumans can't even ruin it. Go ahead.
This is like, it feels, I think, of all of the Fantastic Four stuff we've read so far, in terms of pacing, it feels the most like a modern comic. Like, you've got four issues that bleed seamlessly together. It's one big, long story. You're looking at all these different subplots that you're juggling across page to page, and in the end, it all kind of ties together. Whereas a lot of the other Fantastic Four stuff, even the stuff that's been multi-part, you could kind of read it, you know, in something of a standalone fashion. This, if you collected it today in one big trade, it would read seamlessly as one story. I thought it was outstanding in that regard.
And characters are truer than ever, although, you know, we get some classic Reed misogyny throughout towards Sue. We get Reed, you know, unlikable Reed, but still heroic in his own way. We get classic interaction between Ben and Johnny and Wyatt, and their search with Lockjaw is pretty funny. I love this. This was probably the easiest, what's the word? But this and the Spider-Man stuff we're going to cover in the second half was the most joyful, comfortable stuff that is in my wheelhouse to read this week, this month.
Absolutely. Tim, what about you? What did you make of this this Doom and Silver Surfer story? Were you as high on it as Todd and I were?
I don't know if I'm quite as high, but I would agree that it's among the best Fantastic Four material we have read thus far. And to your point about how it does read like a modern comic. But I just enjoy seeing how Lee and Kirby have so embraced that with Doom. We see it with Mephisto as well. They get a lot of mileage out of that with Mephisto as a foil for him. This is also, again, as was mentioned, the kind of debut of Doom's power-stealing gimmick, which he will go to that well quite a bit. And it all just, and the stuff with the Inhumans too, of course, it just all feels like we have come a long way from days of those somewhat forced one-and-done stories from earlier in this series. You know, think back to when we had those really almost arbitrary chapter breaks within the issues themselves, and it was just sort of like, I don't know, it shows how much this series has changed and how much this series has changed comics themselves, that Stan can really flex his muscles here and just lean into that serialized narrative. So I enjoyed it structurally on that level. Content-wise, I would agree that the Fantastic Four themselves have kind of moved up to the level of being as interesting as the stuff going on around them, which I think has kind of been, they've kind of been the one weak link in our own book, if that makes any sense. And we do see that change here. So a lot of good stuff. There's more we can get into, but I think I've talked enough. So let's turn it over to our last panelist.
Yeah, Russell, your thoughts on this one. I think sounds so far like all of us were pretty high on it.
Yeah, definitely. This was a continued high quality that we had gotten to at the Galactus Saga. It just continues on here. The, like has already been said, the best parts of this for me kind of came down to the Doom and Silver Surfer bits. Every time we're flashing over to that part of the story, I am just so intrigued by everything that's happening there with him manipulating a being on the cosmic power level of Silver Surfer, who honestly is a bit naive, but I think that plays into his character a good bit. And he's learning about the evils of Earth, so to speak. And I felt like there was a part of this story that that really hit with me, especially in 59. Even though 59 is pretty heavy on exposition, you actually get to this point where Doom defeats the Fantastic Four using the powers that he stole from the Silver Surfer. And instead of just outright killing them, which he could have done, in his head, it made more sense to let them live in humiliation, especially as far as Reed Richards was concerned. And I finally started to see what Ben Morris had been referring to about Reed and Doom being kind of each other's blind spot in terms of doing things logically. Because if it had been anybody else, Doom probably would have just killed him. But Doom doesn't just want Reed dead. He wants him broken and humiliated and in a way subservient to Doom. And this is kind of a difficult ending to pull off, and to pull off in a believable way, but the way the story flows up to that point, I felt like this was maybe the best presentation of it that I've seen up to now, that actually made me feel like, okay, this makes sense in the context that Doom really wants Reed beaten down and at his lowest possible point. And it even ties back to some things that we saw in earlier Fantastic Four issues, like specifically the one after Doom thinks that he's killed Reed Richards, thinks that he's killed the entire Fantastic Four. And instead of, you know, being master of the world, he retreats into his country, into Latveria, and is being entertained by this goofball hypnotist who breaks that spell off of him, so that he realizes, no, the Fantastic Four are not dead. I've been fooled this entire time, but during this whole time that the Fantastic Four have been supposedly gone, you've just sat on your ass and done nothing. So I felt like this is really illustrating that that callback, that tie back to that story, and the continued developing rivalry between these two. Like they kind of need each other in order for things to be as we know them, or for Doom to be performing at his peak level. He kind of needs Reed Richards there to be his punching bag. As far as the Inhumans stuff goes, it's mostly okay, but it's also mostly kind of forgettable for me. And in issue 60, we get this random flash of the Watcher, which is just to tell us that he's leaving. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, fuck right off. Who cares? But I think we should call out the we get a Doctor Doom versus Thing rematch in 60. That's pretty damn good stuff. I love Thing in big throwdown fights like that against someone who's able to challenge him on that level. And we'll see that a little bit more in later issues. But that was a good fight, and I actually really loved Reed versus Doom. Also, and I believe that was also in 60, because it felt like a full callback to the battle with Galactus. Mm-hmm. And I felt like there was a lot of really good synergy there. So Fantastic Four, firing on all cylinders. Can't really say anything negative, too negative about it. There's some wonky bit in there with the Wizard and Sandman, but it was entertaining.
Right.
It was fun to read, but it was like you get to the end of it and it's like, oh, that was just there to.
What is that Sandman costume, by the way?
Dear God, it's awful.
Good Lord. Like,
it's so dressed like a pine tree.
Like, I mean, I understand they think the striped t-shirt is not a very generic look, but this is not the way to fix it. Not everybody needs a goofy ass headpiece, you know?
No, Jack. God, this absolute worst look for Sandman ever.
Yes.
You wouldn't have even known it was him until he displays his powers. He's written in the same goofy manner, though, so he's still funny.
Right.
And all of this whole subplot with him and the Wizard basically comes to absolutely nothing. So it's really just there to, you know, have Fantastic Four something to do while Doom is manipulating Silver Surfer. So it's kind of a comic book trope to do stuff like that. So it works. It's at least it's fun and entertaining to read, but it is apropos of absolutely nothing in the rest of the issue. So you take it with a grain of sand, if you will.
Before we move on, and before my internet cuts out again, there is a panel in 59 that is just timeless. It's a close-up of Doom's bloodshot eyes saying Doomsday. And it's kind of looks like the panel that launched Walt Simonson's career. It's so good. It just makes me – it could be in a comic today. It could be in a comic from 20 years from now. It's that beautifully done by Kirby.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. And in the way that we never see his face, right? That's part of the whole, you know, allure of the character, is just this great mystery of what does he really look like beyond knowing that he's horribly disfigured, of course. But the emotion that Kirby wrings out of this is just, God, it's really striking.
Yeah, I mean, it's so well done from an artistic standpoint throughout these four issues. So let's move on.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, that's
fine. I know we're trying to move on from this, but it just occurs to me, you know, the resolution of this story kind of takes Doom off the board, or at least looks like it could be taking him off the board. Do you all feel like we are at a point where, or we are at least approaching the point where Dr. Doom sort of needs a rest? As a character, as a,
you know,
as the, you know, signature antagonist for this team, for this book.
On the one hand, I can see where you're coming from. On the other hand, though, I've kind of gotten to that point a few times with him throughout this project, and yet every time they bring him back for a big story, it seems to be better than the story that immediately preceded it.
It's kind of like hits the reset button every time. There has not been another, with the exception of Galactus, a compelling Fantastic Four villain besides Doom to me. You know, the Frightful Four, we get these characters that show up as maybe villains at one point, but then they become supporting characters. So I think they're still trying to find something else besides Doom that works on a recurring basis, and Doom always works.
Yeah, it's difficult to find a good like Fantastic Four villain outside of Doctor Doom. So I'm kind of with Nick on this one that I get fully where you're coming from, Tim, because it's like, I mean, how many times can you keep going back to this well? But it's still working. So I figure, you know, if you ever get to a point where you write a bad Doctor Doom story, yeah, then maybe take a break and try something different, because then people will just wind up really appreciating him that much more. So it keeps working for me.
I think with most characters and in the hands of most creators, you would hit that point of diminishing returns sooner or later. And I'm sort of playing devil's advocate by even throwing out the question, because I don't even know if I would agree or try to make the argument that they need to give him a rest. It's just, it's surprising that he does still work as well as he does and is still as effective. And as was pointed out, the story is getting better and better. So while you sort of think there's a risk here, if it works, you know, let's not try to fix what ain't broken yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's just – it'll be interesting to track that, though, and see if there comes a point where these Doctor Doom stories understand, and Jack, there's just nowhere else to take it, because this did feel pretty huge. Like, it felt like, hey, he has literally the ability to remake the world at this point, and he fails. So what else can you really do with him that's bigger than that? So I'm interested to see where he goes from there. Moving on to more Fantastic Four, we skipped 61, so I don't really know what's in that one. And then we had this little two-part 62 and 63 that featured Reed stuck in the negative zone, being saved by the inhuman Gorgon, I believe it was. Wasn't it Gorgon?
Triton,
sorry. Triton. I get them mixed up. Triton, Gorgon, all those ons, I don't fucking know. Anyway, Triton comes and saves him and inadvertently releases Blastar from the negative zone.
Blastar
as a and Jack Kirby's negative zone here.
It is so weird to me that Blastar becomes even somewhat of a recurring villain for...
Oh, God, I didn't know that. See, you're exposing my lack of Fantastic Four knowledge. I figured we were done with him.
Well, that's the thing. He seems like he would be a one-and-done type villain. There's just not anything compelling about him, anything that seems like it's beyond the surface. He doesn't really have that cool of a gimmick. They talk about his bomb bursts like it's anything special, and it's just kind of, he's a dude with generic energy blasts and has a fun name to say, and that's about it. But you show up here not so much for the story, but for the art. I would have to agree, an absolutely fucking gorgeous Kirby photo collage, double page. Splash 62, and I will just point out, I don't know why 61 was skipped, but in that issue, I kind of skimmed it. It is another returning battle with the Sandman that sent Reed hurtling into the negative zone via his space-time chamber, which we saw in, don't remember the issue number, but it was This Man, This Monster. So a little callback there. We bring that back around. And I don't know. I thought it was the one bit of story I did enjoy, or maybe just tone, is that there's a genuine sense of dread and peril as the team just sort of stands around and they're helplessly watching Reed through the monitor. They can communicate with them, but he's kind of telling them not to because he sees his situation as being so hopeless, and they are utterly helpless. So he is just adrift, going closer and closer to inevitable death with each moment. Has kind of a horror movie feel to it. Mm-hmm. I did enjoy that.
Event Horizon or something like that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's...
Without that.
Great. And probably he lands on the same rock that Blastar is deposited on. So there we go. And it is rescued by Triton, the Inhuman, swimming through space or subspace, I guess.
Yeah. Whatever the negative zone is, this weird You know, it's whatever they want it to be, I think. It's kind of ill-defined, much like the Phantom Zone in Superman, where each writer gets to determine kind of what they wanted the rules to be, it feels like. So it's our first example of a gift for later writers, I think.
Could be. But I take it it's quite easy to traverse if you have bends. So, you know. We make these things up as we go, whatever works.
And Triton had been kind of the least developed of the undeveloped Inhumans mm-hmm. to this point, or mm-hmm. Inhumans, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. And that goes into issue 63, which is Blastar on the loose with this great supervillain team up with the Sandman. Wow. You get a lot of Inhumans in 63 as well. I certainly got the sense that Stan and Jack wanted to be doing an Inhuman series on their own, but I think they were still rather limited by their distribution arrangement and couldn't really do that. So if they feel a bit shoehorned into this series, I would imagine that's why. So, but all in all, not a great follow-up to the excellent Doom story we got preceding this, but you know, the art's always going to be on point when you've got Jack Kirby now fully in the groove and able to concentrate his abilities on FF. And as we talked about in our overview of 66, Thor as well. So this is kind of the best we've seen of Kirby on this book. I think he, after issue 50 of this series, is where he can cut loose, just because he's not spread in so many different directions.
Yeah, he's kind of just, you know, starting to focus on Fantastic Four plus some other little minor projects exclusively. Russell, what about you? What did you make of this? are you going to come to the passionate defense of Blastar?
No. I am going to say that Blastar might be the worst name they've come up with so far. It is just... Oh, this is so fucking stupid.
I would still say the Crime Master is probably the worst, but that's
okay,
just me.
Yeah, yeah.
Crime's yeah. Master.
Crime's Master.
Crime Master might just be the one that was just the most obvious,
yes.
But this was one that seemed like, oh, we're going to try to be clever, but it's still going to come off as lazy, and holy shit, stop it. Also, Reed sacrifices himself once again. Are we calling this a trope yet? Because I'm calling it a trope of Fantastic Four. Reed sacrifices himself. We think once again it's going to be the last we ever see of Reed Richards. Of course it isn't. Triton is going to dive into space because, hey, if he can survive underwater, he can survive in the depths of space, because those two things are exactly the same. Anyway, that's enough of me just like straight up shitting on it. Sandman still looks stupid. I will say, though, that the ending gave me a legit hardcore chuckle, because Blastar gets built up as this I'll be honest, it kind of struck me as a bit of a doomsday build-up for Blastar. Yeah, he's being dumped off by these alien creatures. They're like, this creature is just too uncontrollable. We can't deal with him. He's wrapped in a containment suit, even. And I'm getting real doomsday vibes off of him. So I'm thinking, oh, man, this – and we see his power level seems to be stronger than anything that the Fantastic Four have come up against in terms of like just sheer brute physical strength. So I'm thinking, all right, this could be a really interesting fight with Thing. And Thing proceeds to hand Blastar his ass, which was absolutely tremendous and legit hilarious at the end, whenever he just gets hauled off to prison. And Thing is just kind of grumbling like he's, you know, a slightly glorified garbage man who's just here to clean up after everyone. So that part kind of popped me pretty well, so I was enjoying that. I will give it credit, though, for having some the emotion from Ben and Sue when it does seem like Reed is not going to be able to get back from the negative zone. I actually thought that was written really well. I thought that I felt like legit emotional response coming from them written in a way that felt earnest and sincere. So mm-hmm. that part actually really did worked for me for the most part. And of course, you guys have already verbally filleted the Kirby art to a point where I don't feel like I could do a better job of it. So just got to say that 2-page spread inside the negative zone, man, you just, it's another one of those that you just have to see. I mean, that's what really makes these two issues really worth reading, is a master performing at the top of his game. So go get you some of that Jack Kirby art, stay for the fight at the end, but don't expect a whole lot more than that. But that's still plenty.
Absolutely. Todd, what about you? Anything to add here on Jack Kirby or Blast Star?
Well, I came to the Fantastic Four in the early 80s when John Byrne was drawing a long Negative Zone saga. And I don't know if any of you have read this, maybe Tim, where it was Annihilus was the chief villain of the Negative Zone. And it was dark, and not just visually dark, but storyline was very dark and bleak. Yeah. And you got kind of the foreshadowing into that here. As far as Team Sandblast, not necessarily the most compelling villain team. Blastar himself is very, very basic. He blasts things. But he does, you know, the creation of Blastar reminds me a little bit of early 80s cartoon television show called Thundar the Barbarian, at least as far as the name. And that was created by Jack Kirby. So I got a little bit of that kind of... Kirby was the most creative individual I can think of in the 20th century. He just created so many things, so many different directions. His mind was always going. Not all of them are going to be winners. And I don't know how much of Blastar is Kirby and how much is Lee, but perhaps later appearances of him will be more compelling, because at right now it was kind of a much ado about nothing. But the art was great, and it was interesting because we just saw the high point of what a Fantastic Four comic can be, and then this was very mediocre as far as the writing. But the art was you know, what you'd expect from Kirby of this era. So I'm going to – it's still kind of middle of the road for me, but important to see. They're definitely going places with Sue and Reed, I think you can tell. And she has some kind of interesting lines here. Forgive me for suddenly turning femme, stuff like that. but they're going somewhere with their marriage, and it's been 6 years since they've been together. I mean, that's a long time in comic books and real life.
Absolutely. So, yeah, with all that being said, I think, guys, we're going to go ahead and take a break here. We've come to about half of our reading list for this episode, so we're going to take a little break, and when we come back on the other side, we're going to wrap up our discussion of Fantastic Four by talking about issue 65 and the fifth annual from this series, and then we're going to hop over to Strange Tales to talk some Nick Fury and some Doctor Strange. We, ladies and gentlemen, will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hi there. Have you recently gone through a crisis? Did you find out your friends had been lying to you for years to cover up something they did? Have you discovered that one of your bitter enemies might actually be three people? Were you seemingly killed by a new god only to find yourself quantum leaping through time until you make it back to the present? Was your entire reality wiped out in a cosmic battle between two godlike beings only to be reborn, destroyed, and reborn again? Then join me, Russell Sellers, and my special guests as we help you manage your post-crisis life in DC Post-Crisis Management, a limited monthly series starting in September. We can't promise you closure, but we will try to avoid destroying your hometown and turning you into a homicidal maniac who wipes out time.
Welcome back, listeners of the Marvel Age podcast. We're here, back here for the second half of our show. We're going to continue our discussion of the Fantastic Four in 1967. We come back to the Fantastic Year for issue 65 that features the debut of Ronan the Accuser. He shows up here in Fantastic Four to, get this, accuse the Fantastic Four of something. I know that's a plot twist nobody saw coming. For me, this is kind of the same, kind of a better version of what Blastar was, honestly. Like, I think artistically it's a tour de force. It's certainly more interesting than Blastar from a narrative perspective, but still nothing approaching that the level of that Doctor Doom story from early in 67. So while I wound up enjoying this, again, it was primarily for the Jack Kirby art. Russell, how'd you feel about this debut of Ronan the Accuser?
It's Ronan the Public Accuser,
yes,
as opposed to the private accuser. I mean, we have to discern these things.
Some people have their privates accused of things.
that they do. And considering the abilities that Reed's privates have, I'm sure that there could be accusations flung that way. But I digress. Lots of little things introduced here, but for me, not fully memorable, I guess, other than, I guess we'll go ahead and say it. Sue's pregnant with Franklin.
There you go.
There we go. That's the big one. That's really the biggest revelation here. And then, of course, the introduction of Ronan, who will probably, I mean, I guess he's going to be important in a few stories later. And of course, folks who are more casual fans will know him from his appearance in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, probably in the upcoming Captain Marvel movie as well.
Definitely.
Because he's tied to the Kree. I mean, he is a Kree. He's part of that. Not working all that hard on certain names here because we got a introduction of Psycho Man, whose powers are not all that far removed from a DC character introduced in 1944 called Psycho Pirate.
Yes. That's, of course, an annual number five that the Psycho Man's introduced.
Yeah, that's an annual five. FF65 just didn't really move the needle much for me other than, you know, here's Ronan the Accuser. He's accusing the Fantastic Four of, you know, destruction of a Kree outpost, if I'm remembering correctly.
Something like that.
Yeah, and it's just kind of whatever. I felt like the annual had a little bit more to offer in terms of story. Like 65 was more or less just getting us there. Are we talking about the annual already too?
Oh, we'll do 65 first and then jump over to the annual.
All right. Well, not much for me from 5 because it's just not that memorable of an issue, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree. Tim, what about you? What are your thoughts here on 65 with Ronan the Accuser and Sue's pregnancy announcement?
So Ronan the Accuser, the public accuser, excuse me, mm-hmm. he seems sort of like a cast off from Haters Ball. the way he just kind of goes around the galaxy.
Got the stick.
Shit talking people. He's got his.
I hate you. I hate you. I especially hate you.
Who's IQ's you?
Mm-hmm. There you go. He's got a tone of impenetrability. Very impressive. This is maybe notable, at least to us, for being the first time we have seen the Kree, right? I don't think they've come up in our reading list before. This can't be their first, like,
it's
real.
Not. I think that reference about an outpost being destroyed is referencing an earlier book that we didn't read.
The issue before this was the Seeker, right? Or the Sentry.
I don't have a clue because I didn't read it. So you tell me.
Which they destroyed. Yes, they did destroy that. The Sentry. Excuse me. Which is like a big robot type guy. Remember the recorder from. The issue we read in 66 with Ego, the Living Planet, all that stuff. He's kind of like that before the Kree, sort of.
No, according to Wikipedia, their first appearance was in Fantastic Four 65 in August of 1967.
Yeah, that's sort of shocking to me. Well, they did destroy their little robot recorder dude the issue before that, so I don't know why we skipped it, but we did. I did appreciate seeing the cabbage-headed sovereign of the Kree Empire, the Supreme Intelligence, mm-hmm. in the opening pages. He's always a favorite of mine. Gonna see a lot more of him in the years ahead, so more gifts that will populate this reading list.
There you are.
But issue itself, neither here nor there. Does Ronan make a great first impression? Not really, but we'll see better from him, too.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. I mean, he's still a character that hangs around to this day as a foundation or a building block of the Marvel Cosmic universe. So, Todd, tell us why we're wrong in not being completely in love with the Kree and Ronan the Accuser here early on.
I mean, we get the Skrulls here in early Fantastic Four, or literally the second issue of Fantastic Four, and here we get the Kree, and these are both big-time cosmic building blocks, and you'll see these characters, these empires endure to this very day and be in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That's how important they end up being. But they're not necessarily any more or less compelling than some of the other no-name, done-in-one alien invaders that you see in the page four and Avengers at this point. But Supreme Intelligence is definitely an interesting kind of visual. You know, it's this disembodied giant fat head with tentacles. You know, you kind of imagine it hanging out watching Chatterbait all day.
What's he got to be watching Chatterbait?
Good.
And
You know, Ronan himself is an interesting design. The hammer is no big deal. We've seen hammers before, but the cone of impenetrability is interesting. But this is not a great issue by any means, and I'm not going to defend it, especially when we just had awesome Fantastic Four earlier in this year. I'm kind of more interested in why – well, I'm kind of interested in this Alicia subplot where she gets mysteriously – kidnapped by somebody we don't know who it is. That's interesting to me in the big picture. And knowing that 2 issues later, we get the reveal of Adam Warlock, who would be end up being a very important Marvel character, and that's not on our reading list. So I don't know. I can't tell you what's the – if Ronan is more important to the Herald, comic book Herald, than Adam Warlock. I mean, Fantastic Four, every issue – kind of means something to the Marvel universe.
You know,
every issue is significant at this point. And you'd say that almost about the entire 100 and whatever issue run of Lee and Kirby. Go ahead, Nick.
And you know what's crazy is not to get too far down the road, but this is actually the final issue of Fantastic Four that we are going to read, you know, in terms of the monthly series, all the way until 1970. We have none on our reading list for 68 or 69. The only issue is an annual. So
he and Sue have some of the most cringeworthy stuff at this point. You know, when he's taking her out on the town and being lovey-dovey, it's just barf me out, gag me with a spoon. Not
among other things.
Sorry. Yeah. anyway, so yeah, 65 is important for Ronan, I guess, because Ronan is a character that millions of people have seen in the Guardians film, but. Other than that, no, not a big deal.
Yeah.
Leaving out Morlocks, that really does. I mean, I know he's not the character that he will become later, but that sounds pretty suspect given some of the stuff we have read. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah, we're just going with what we have here, guys.
Yes.
It's going to be interesting.
We've got one issue of Fantastic Four. We're going to read 77 and 68.
Oh, you're right. I skipped that one over. So we got, yeah. So, but not in 69.
Yeah, but then 69 is void of all Fantastic Four.
Yep. It's going to be interesting. We have very little. I mean, this is the last year that we really spend a lot of time with the Fantastic Four for the rest of this project, really. Or at least until we get into some of the more, you know, longer form story arcs, I guess. John Byrne and stuff like that, I'm assuming, is probably pretty heavy on our 1980s list. But in any event, moving on to Annual 5, this sees the Psycho Man pop up. We've read, let's see, what annuals have we read? We read 1, 2, and
1
3.
1 and 2.
Did we not read 3?
Oh, and 3. We got the marriage in 3, yeah.
Yeah, so we read.
We skipped 4.
Yeah, we did not read Annual 4, but this is the fourth annual we read for this project, and I thought it was hands down the worst. Like, not even close. The other three that we read at least offered something major, felt important, and this just felt like another issue of Fantastic Four. Psycho Man, what is he only able? What is it? Fear, hate, and doubt, and that's all he's got. You know, like at least with the Psycho Pirate, he has multiple different masks. Whereas this guy, he's got the one little box, and if those three pre-programmed buttons aren't working for him, he's pretty much shit out of luck. So I don't know. I kind of despise this. Even artistically, it was fine, but this was not the best annual effort. I felt Todd. Annual 5 do anything for you?
Come on. This is not a great representation of the Fantastic Four. You know, it is. You can tell it's an annual. The panel's on a little bigger. There's a little more splash pages. Yeah. They throw everything but the kitchen sink in with characters. You get a lot of Black Panther, a lot
Black
of Inhumans.
Inhumans, yep.
But, yeah, no, it's pretty crappy. No offense, Stan and Jack. This is not your best work, not your best annual. But there's a cool Silver Surfer solo tale. Say that three times.
And
fast
a Jack Kirby written look at the Marvel bullpen.
That is interesting, isn't it? The Lee and Kirby making fun of – actually, the Kirby making fun of Lee and Kirby is very fun and very weird but cool. Yeah, we should talk about that if we're going to talk about this this annual, because there's early shot at Roy Thomas by Jack Kirby. There would be later shots at Roy Thomas in the pages of the New Gods later on in Kirby's repertoire in the 70s. And
Right. That's probably the most notable thing in this, because honestly, even the Silver Surfer issue, it being his first kind of like solo story, it's kind of forgettable. Quasimodo is not exactly the most dynamic villain. So yeah, probably the best thing in this annual is that little page you know, Jack making fun of everyone thing, which I know probably warms your heart quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially, I mean, looking at the way he draws Stan with his very receding slick back hairline and everything but the kitchen sink again in this one. This is pretty funny. And Kirby has a good sense of humor about himself here,
right,
too, yeah, which is great to see.
Self-awareness.
And Mole Man shows up at the very end, which is cool. And Mole Man doesn't show up a lot in Fantastic Four comics, which is interesting. He was their very first villain, but quickly supplanted by Dr. Doom is the most compelling thing showing up in Fantastic Four. That'd be more interesting to me if Dr. Doom came and bugged Lee and Kirby again like he did in the early pages of Fantastic
Four. Oh, yeah. That's right.
Tim, what about you? This annual, anything?
I mean, I guess the gimmick of guest stars galore is sort of fun. You get Black
it's
Panther.
It's fine,
in
but
here.
They've done it so, better so many times before that it kind of.
Yeah. I mean, in the entirety of the Inhumans, I think we're a little bit over it.
yeah, once you get the Crystal and Johnny, you know, reunion.
Yeah.
What's the hook here exactly?
Yep. They're just sort of hanging around now. So let's shit or get off the pot. Reed and Sue are kind of sidelined for this one, so we see more Ben and Johnny, which they're fun as a duo. But the Cyberman, so help me out here. He's a microscopic being from the microverse who has entered our universe and is inhabiting this and controlling this exoskeleton with very limited degrees of control over the emotional spectrum. Is that about the long and the short of it? And again, someone you don't expect to be a recurring villain. He could be another one-off, but we will be seeing more of him as well in years ahead. The Silver Surfer solo tale is not bad, but the Quasimodo thing is a little bit beneath him. Quasimodo, little comic skater, at least in this story. Like, what an asshole. Just, you know, he got what he wanted. You know, I mean, the amazing coincidence of happening upon this being with unlimited power and is going to use that to help you out, and you're just going to be an ungrateful shithead. Wow. Just an entitled piece of shit. He got what he deserved by the end of that. That was, you know. Don't piss off the Silver Surfer, man. And, beyond that, we get the very meta bullpen bulletins thing by Jack Kirby, which I think I spent more time just identifying who everyone was because he was throwing just so much stuff in there in the background and the panels. Very busy, but, yes, very funny. So not a lot to remark upon in this annual. But it's not the worst thing in the world.
Gotcha. Russell, annual thoughts here?
I've already covered my thoughts on Psycho Man, saying he's a poor man psycho pirate. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody else has kind of remarked on that. I did actually somewhat like the microverse reveal and his motivations for wanting to conquer Earth, having to do with trying to find a new place for his people to live because their population was apparently out of control where he was, and they were going to, you know, eventually go extinct because they were going to use up all of their resources or they just had nowhere else to go. So he's trying to find.
He should talk to Thanos about that.
Right. It seems like this is a person that would probably have a lot to talk about with Thanos, but. And that part, I was like, okay, well, you've got a good idea here, but your execution in this issue is just really off. Because up to that reveal, Psycho Man just comes off as another mustache-twirling villain. And I got no time for him, honestly. The Silver Surfer part, you guys covered that pretty well. Quasimodo is kind of a microcosm of Comicsgate.
Really?
Back in the 60s. And it's over as quickly as it begins. And it still felt like it went on forever, even though it was actually a pretty short story, honestly. The Jack Kirby like making fun of everybody at Marvel thing, that was good. That's legit funny. That's some good true LOL moments for this story. So if you're going to read anything from the annual, that would be it. But I think, as you guys have already pointed out, this little two-parter can just piss right off. It's boring. It's sad because this is Fantastic Four slipping back into some old bad habits from its early days when we were very critical of it, after we've just had two really solid high points. So, yeah, that's just where we are, I guess. But I think what we're going to talk about next is going to wind up making this story look pretty damn good by comparison.
I don't know that I would go quite that far, but yeah, it's
a little far. I'm going to be honest here. I'm not going to be as low, I don't think, on some of these upcoming issues as a couple of people are.
Yeah, well, so let's dive right into it. Let's move over to Strange Tales, and let's actually take the better part of it first, just because I want to go ahead and get to something that we obviously need to cover here on the show. We'll start with the Doctor Strange portion of Strange Tales, and we'll start there because this week we lost another member of the classic Marvel family, an artist who probably doesn't get as much credit as she deserves for being as influential and iconic as she truly was. You say you never want to be the guy that follows the guy, and she kind of had that unfortunate role of being the person who had to follow the unfollowable Steve Ditko on Doctor Strange here in Strange Tales. But Marie Severin, as we touched on a little bit last time we talked Doctor Strange, just brings an outstanding art style to Doctor Strange. It's a different visual styling, but it's one that holds up very well. And so we send out our condolences to the family, and we hope that everybody listening will take a few moments out of your day. Go look up some of this Marie Severin art from Doctor Strange. I don't think you'll be disappointed. But real quick, before we dive into the context of the issue, anybody else want to add anything, any thoughts on Marie Severin and her passing?
I was not too terribly familiar with her art prior to reading this.
Yeah, me
either. And in fact, I would say read these issues just days before her unfortunate passing. And while I'm glad I did get to glean some appreciation for her art, I wish I could have done so maybe a little bit earlier. And she's one of those artists who never had a long regular stint on any series. I mean, I think this little stretch of Strange Tales that she does is kind of the extent of her contributions to that series. But she's one of those, I don't know, maybe pitch hitters in a way that she'll come in and do really great to solid work on the books that need it. And that's a pretty valuable asset to have, especially at Marvel and their history right now. You look at her resume through really the late 60s into the 70s and 80s, and it's kind of stuff here and there, and there is a sense of it feels like she maybe didn't get her due. And her style, yeah, stylistically very different from what we've encountered before, but a lot of this stuff worked, and we'll get into this as we discuss the issues themselves. Works really, really well. And there's a world where, and it should have been this world, where she had like an epic long run on a beloved fantasy or sword and sorcery
Conan series. Or something, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, like a Conan series. And, you know, it's kind of a shame that maybe she didn't particularly want to be a regular artist. I don't know. I'm not going to pretend to have any insight into that, but I think she's better than her credits would attest to.
Anybody else got?
And
you want to chime in?
Yeah, I know she co-created Spider-Woman, who's gone on to be a lasting character.
I think Todd's having some technical difficulties. Russell, do you have anything you want to chime in here while Todd is away?
Well, like Tim, I wasn't very familiar with her work before we started this project. But since, you know, reading this early Doctor Strange stuff and jumping, you know, ahead to looking at her co-creation of Spider-Woman, yeah, her art was for sure influential on quite a number of art at Marvel and at DC, and I think comic artists just throughout throughout history. So it's certainly a sharp loss for the comics community, but very strong legacy left behind by her. So I would hope people would go and check out more of her stuff, and you can find plenty of it on Marvel Unlimited. So well worth your time to go and check out.
Todd, before you get interrupted by technical difficulties, you were in the thought on Marie Severin.
Just, you know, her art reminds me of the old packaging and supplementary art you would get with Dungeons and Dragons. And, yep. You know, also had a Golden Age and EC Comics kind of look to
it. Oh, yeah,
it too.
Yeah, good call.
You know. I just would love to learn more about Marie Severin. I think we have an opportunity here to really enjoy this, the five issues of Strange Tales. Just kind of a melancholy coincidence that Steve Ditko just died, and again, mm-hmm. This is her on Strange Tales. Marie Severin just died. Just kind of sucks.
It does. Indeed.
She did some work for EC Comics in the 50s. It looks like.
Interesting.
So yeah. Mm-hmm.
Makes sense given her artistic style. But yeah, let's dive into the issues themselves. We pick up Doctor Strange here, and we see him up against Umar, who I believe they say is the sister of Dormammu. Did I read that correctly, or was she otherwise related to Dormammu in some way? But she was seeking revenge against Doctor Strange for his humiliation and imprisonment of Dormammu. And then later on we get to see the actions he takes cause the Living Tribunal to come and confront him. So we get to see that's a pretty cool concept. But, you know, plot-wise, fine. You know, him battling Umar and trying to save Clea and things of that nature. But as we alluded to, the art here is really the standout. You guys have said it so beautifully with the kind of an EC vibe, kind of a sword and sorcery type vibe that fits Doctor Strange to AT. Todd, talk to me a little bit about these five Doctor Strange stories here in Strange Tales. How'd they hold up for you?
Yeah, it's interesting to see Strange against a new villain, not Baron Mordu, not Dormammu, you don't have any, but Umar, who at first is a beautiful woman, kind of a classic witch type character, and then she gets revealed to be this disgusting, weird design in the kind of the second group, and incapacitates the Ancient One, or the Ancient One is involved protecting Doctor Strange because Umar reveals her true form and is here on Earth. The story is pretty good, but again, the art is wonderful. And here we have another writing transition as Stan Lee starts out this arc and then Roy Thomas finishes it up. So we're getting – no, I'm sorry. It's Stan Lee throughout. Mm-hmm. I apologize. I thought Roy Thomas was writing
scripts,
this.
I think he scripts at least the first issue of this. And he's doing a very spot-on Stan impersonation.
Right.
I did notice his name in the credits at some point. So,
yeah, he does write at least the last one too.
Yeah, yeah. So you could be forgiven for thinking it was Stan.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting here that Doctor Strange essentially loses. Like, he saves Clea, but Umar kind of gets loose and you know, is able to essentially accomplish what she wanted. It's an interesting take on it to do a Doctor Strange fails kind of story, in my view anyway.
Well, can we talk about Zom?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting to me.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tim.
Interesting visual.
Yeah.
A little bit craft beer bro-y with the whole Forlock business, so I'm not sure I really got it. Maybe this is me being a little dense here. So, Doctor Strange, after Zom is unleashed to combat the menace of Umar, now they've got a bigger problem on their hands, and he has to retrieve the Forlock of his, which is his top knot, basically, of Zom. Mm-hmm. But that unleashes far greater evils.
It should have been his foreskin, I think, that they were trying to get.
You know, comics code being what it is. And this brings about the introduction of, yes, the Living Tribunal, who you want to talk about an interesting visual.
Yes.
And one that has evolved very little over the years.
Yeah, it's kind of one that they nailed from the jump, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is one I had no idea Maurice Severin had a hand in his creation or design. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was not familiar. I didn't know when he popped up. So his appearance here is kind of like, oh, we're doing this already? Okay, cool. And he's sort of the supreme authority in the pecking order of the Marvel cosmic beings. So he's a pretty big fucking deal, showing up here as he does. And I aside from the Zom bit, which I'm not sure I really fully grasped.
Well, we skipped an issue in here that kind of felt.
We did.
I felt like I was missing something whenever we came back to the story, you know. So I don't know.
I thought that was Umar's true form, but no, that's Zom. That's the monster you had to break free to defeat Umar. Apparently, I'm sorry. Zom is a really interesting design.
Kind of Mangoggy a little bit in the design, which is another character that I don't think we've touched on yet. That somewhat blasphemous to say as a Thor fan, but never been that big of a fan, honestly. So just one of those deals. Russell, anything you got to add here on this Doctor Strange stuff?
It was an interesting art shift, I have to admit, because going from the two different styles of Ditko to Severin, it jarred me a little bit at first. And the story, to me, in the beginning, felt like we were moving Doctor Strange more towards being closer to your standard superhero stuff, like we've gotten from other books. But by the time we get to all the stuff with, you know, Living Tribunal, all that is way out the window, and we are fully back into, you know, the Doctor Strange that I love so good from these past few months. So really interesting and fun stuff there. Certainly the more entertaining part of the Strange Tales issues that we had to read. And yeah, I think you guys have pretty well covered it. Not really a ton to add there, but I did especially enjoy the final parts of this. I thought that this was all done incredibly well. I guess not much else to add. You guys covered it so well.
I have to go back and see if either Roy Thomas or Stan Lee were involved in any lawsuits at this point, because this is kind of like a evil judge character, or at least not an evil judge, an a-hole judge character. Thrown in, and it's just a great visual design, though. And Living Tribunal exists to this day in the Marvel Universe.
There you go. So before we leave Doctor Strange, any final thoughts from anyone before we jump over to a part that wasn't as strong?
We did get the Ancient One.
We did.
Being dispatched in some fashion. I think he gets better. I don't believe that's the last we see of him, but feels like a big deal at the time. This is Doc Strange's mentor, and he is now without him, and has these greater threats to face in the world. So I don't know how much we're going to be sticking with this series, this character, in the years ahead, but I don't know. I'm still kind of digging it. I'm still pretty into it, even without the pretty key ingredient in Steve Ditko.
Yeah, I am as well. Like, I've really been enjoying it. So it's interesting to see that it definitely becomes de-emphasized. We kind of leave Doctor Strange behind for a little bit here in the years ahead. But moving over to something that I'm torn about whether or not I want to leave it behind, because on the one hand, I don't think they could do anything at this point to make the character of Nick Fury less interesting to me. These stories are boring. They're a slog to get through. They're cliched. They're just not entertaining in any shape, form, or fashion. And then they go and put Jim Steranko on it. And early on here in 153 to 155, it's just the same old, same old. But slowly as you go along, it becomes more visually dynamic and inventive, and Steranko is kind of doing things that he's interested in doing, and he slowly takes over. I mean, I think the first issue it says it's scripted by Thomas, edited by Stan, layout by Jack, and Steranko is just doing the penciling, whereas by 57 and 58, it's like drawn and scripted by Steranko, so that you know, this at least builds the foundation for what I am looking forward to getting into next time we encounter Nick Fury. But good God, this character is just bland and generic and boring as fuck, even if they are giving him a hell of a dynamic artist and a hell of a unique visual styling here by the end of it. I don't even care about talking about the plot. You guys can get into the plot if you want to. Fuck it, it wasn't interesting.
I gotta say, though, that I'll agree with you, the way the dialogue is written, especially in the early going, wow, it sucked. And it doesn't really get that much better even when Steranko winds up scripting the issues. The art really off with him, though. I actually wound up looking at it more for that and largely skipping over what was being said. I just kind of skimmed it to get the gist of it. But I noticed that towards the end of this story, the end of this arc, that you get less dialogue.
Yes.
Like Steranko is starting to focus in more on the visual storytelling aspect of it, as opposed to the way Stan and Jack approach Nick Fury with, like, just bubbles upon bubbles upon bubbles.
Of cliche tough guy dialogue.
Like, cliche tough guy bullshit dialogue. And some of that starts to disappear, and even some of Nick Fury's mannerisms start to fade more to the background as Steranko hones in on what I still feel like was a Stan Lee mandated plot.
Right. That's what I was about to say is 153 through 155, it feels like Steranko pretty much trying to do Stan and Jack, whereas 157, 158 starts to feel like Steranko is beginning to transcend the character into more of what he wants it to be, which is why I'm saying I am actually genuinely looking forward to reading Nick Fury more in the future than I did here.
Yes. And that's really where I'm at, is I feel like there's a lot to like here in terms of what Steranko is teasing, but we've got a little bit to go before we're going to fully get there. Stan Lee has got to get out of the way.
Yeah, I'm looking at page 8 of 157, if you guys are looking at it, and that, I mean, like, that alone is unlike anything we've seen, you know, in page 9 in your Marvel Unlimited reader, but page 8 of the actual comic. That's what I want more of, you know, this type of stuff.
Yeah, like I am wanting much more of what we get towards the end of this, which was a heavy focus on the espionage stuff, especially once Nick Fury gets a costume that's much more familiar to I guess to people who are familiar with the character. Like, this is getting closer to his popular look. But we're still inundated with way too much expositional text. That needs to go away for a while. And we have future knowledge, so we know it's going to. We also get more cool gadgets and some unfortunate, unnecessary background on Dum Dum Dugan that nobody's going to remember or give a shit about. But other than that, there are building blocks that are being put in place here by Steranko that are only going to help this series going forward. So I am actually very much looking forward to what will be coming up later. So this could be fun, but it's not there just yet. But I actually wound up really liking the plot of this, the reveal of Hydra Supreme, the return of Baron Strucker, or Von Strucker, excuse me. That all kind of worked for me. I was like, okay, you've got groundwork laid here. Now how are you going to capitalize on it? What's going to be this book going forward? So I'm actually, I'm still thinking I want to see where it goes, even though I don't have a ton of, you know, expectations right now. But we'll see.
Absolutely. Tim, what about you? I think you're closer to where I am on it.
Yeah, man, I'm kind of a lot closer to where you are with this. 153 is Staranko on finishes, basically, over Jack Kirby thumbnails, I guess. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, that's kind of worse than if he just wasn't there at all, because it, just knowing what's to come in the future, in his future, and in the series itself, he feels so handcuffed by it. So 153 is an extremely frustrating issue for me. And the story is just not really there. So I was like, all right, that one was a bit of a slog, but thinking it's going to get better here. 154 was, you get more of the Staranko art, but it's just covered with the 50-foot word balloons. It's like you could tell Stan was like maybe a little gun-shy about turning over the artistic reins fully to somebody else, and not to mention, I think the plot, you know, Staranko is carrying the lion's share of by then as well, but Stan just is maybe just reluctant to give him the nod. So what you end up with is basically a comic that isn't a comic. It's basically a prose story with words arranged in a strange fashion on the page. You can barely make out the art. I mean, it's mm-hmm. absurd. I thought that 154 was just kind of the worst pure issue we've read of anything at this point. It was ridiculous with the mountains of text. Things are looking up from there. Once Staranko is fully on board as writer-artist, he's turning the series into his own. Vast improvement. You pointed out, Nick, that that gorgeous and very trippy page in 157, where kind of his own version of the Kirby photo collage, right? Mm-hmm. Where I think it's identified as a hallucination cube that Nick Fury has ingested, and it's all these, I don't even know how to describe the images that you're seeing. It's very, very trippy, and that's just kind of a taste of, you know, strap in, we're going to see more of that, and I am so looking forward to it. The plot itself does start to move at a better clip too. It's almost like a Winter Soldier meets Invasion of the Body Snatchers, what they're doing with this sort of Hydra infiltration deal and some of the paranoia that he stoked. Of course, the Baron Strucker reveal as the supreme leader of Hydra, which I don't know that that's what Stan's intent was, but too bad. This is Staranko's book now, so he makes that work, I think, a lot better than what we would have gotten. And I think more importantly, just the words move a lot better with the art by this point. So it's just a breezier, easier read. It's not asking so much of you, and it's not the assault on your senses that something like that story in 154, it's just brutal stuff. But things are looking up. We don't get as much good Nick Fury Strange Tales as I'd like to see here in this year, but I think we're out of the woods.
Yeah, we've come through the other side. Todd, your thoughts on Nick Fury and Strange Tales and our first look at Jim Staranko?
153 is bad.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. It's bad. 154 is... Tim thinks it's worse, but to me, it's almost as bad, but by the art, maybe mm-hmm. it's made worse because you see, oh, if only this beautifully drawn story by Staranko had less Invisible. Words around it, you know, so maybe that's what makes it worse in your eyes, but it was maybe a little bit better. Staranko was learning on the job with mm-hmm. that ink. He 153, and then he fully takes over. Eventually, he takes over everything. He takes over plot and script by 57, 58, and the art. So I like the end of this arc quite a bit, 57, mm-hmm. 157, 158. Staranko was kind of like the most interesting man. He is
unique person. If you've ever,
Greg and I were discussing Jim Steranko on a recent episode of Hard Traveling Fanboys, I think, and I don't know, maybe not even, it maybe just been one of our personal phone calls. And I was looking at some of his works, and one of them is a comic book autobiography, Steranko, Graf Prince of Darkness, by Jim Steranko. And if that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about this guy, I don't know what else to say.
One of the best books I've ever written, probably my favorite book, is called The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, by Michael Chabon. I don't know if anybody else has read that, but one of the characters is kind of a hybrid of Jack Kirby, Jim Steranko, and Joe Shuster. So just this really interesting character who's lived and seen a lot and then brings that to comps. So I always kind of see that in the Steranko character. Steranko, the creator, has this just amazing world experience as this guy who studied Harry Houdini and wanted to become an escape artist. But
he was young. He was like 20 at this point.
Yeah, like I said, learning on the job with that inks and then becoming, all right, let me do that. The art improves dramatically just on that second issue. You get to see really cool gadgetry, really good. You know, maybe somebody who learned from Kirby but had his own twists on things. Very dynamic action. The story-wise, I really like the double reveal, the double, double dusty finish of the masks. In 158, you know, where you think it's going one way, it was a totally different way at the end. They sink Hydra Island and it ties up. It wasn't bad. They're still a little wordy. You know, it's still a little over scripted. And Nick Fury's just not that interesting just yet. You know, he's kind of still has that 40s mentality in the 60s, but they're getting there with the character. It's not as bad, I think, overall, if you look at all this, but it has been changed and gets so much better at this point, and it's going to get even better when they go to the solo series coming up.
I think it's a situation where while it's not the bee's knees yet, the gulf in quality between like 153, 154, and where we finished this little run in 158 is enormous.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So they had a lot of improvement to do.
Yeah, but
Steranko had a lot of improvement to do. It's kind of all on him, and he, to his credit, he's turning the ship around fast.
And you know, next in 1968, we will get to see the debut of his solo series, and we'll get to see Steranko take the reins completely. I think we're all looking forward to that. Well, guys, that brings an end to our discussion here of part one of 1967. No year-end awards, of course, because we will save those for the end of our discussion about 1967 part two. Just real quick to tell you guys, our next episode will be covering, like I said, the second half of 1967, that being Avengers 38 and Annual 1, Daredevil 26 and 30, Amazing Spider-Man 47, 49, 50 through 52, Tales of Astonish 93, Uncanny X-Men 35, and Tales of Suspense 93 to 94. So it should be a kind of an eclectic mix of books there in our second half. But real quick before we sign off, of course, as we do every time out, we're going to give everybody an opportunity to kind of plug their stuff, tell people where they can find you on social media. I, of course, can be found at NickDuke87. You can listen to me doing other things on Place to Be Nation Pop, whether it's some football podcast offerings I've done recently, or, of course, part of the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation, The Hard Traveling Fanboys. The most recent episode, by the time this is out, by the way, will have featured the manager, Todd Weber, for a discussion of a film that I have very different thoughts than the general populace on, that being Thor Ragnarok. So tune in for my somewhat controversial, lukewarm takes on that film. Tim, what about you? What do you got going on, and where can people discuss with you if they so feel the need?
Well, I sure wouldn't know anything about having different, unique, controversial takes on things that go against the general public consensus. Mm-hmm. But where you can find me to hear all those takes, shitty and otherwise, on Place to Be Nation Pop, I am the co-host of Talking Pop with Jennifer Smith. Our most recent episode, which you can find as of this recording, is discussing the seminal 90s primetime network drama, Beverly Hills 90210. It's our kind of long-demanded retrospective. I don't think it's going to be the final word on this series in the hallowed halls of Place to Be Nation, but we get into a lot of fun stuff there with an all-star panel. That's right. I said all-star panel. Come at me. On also Place to Be Nation Pop, we have the Place to Be Nation Comics Draft. I'm using the tiny URL version of the
That's fine. We'll accept that. We'll accept that.
So, again, if you're looking for more shit takes and a good time, hit up the giant-sized edition of Hard Traveling Fanboys, where that draft
offer this disclaimer. The thoughts and views expressed by any members of this Nation Fantasy Comics Draft are not necessarily indicative of the thoughts and views of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, who the show bears the name of. Just throwing that
out. But they are the right ones.
They are not indicative of the view, thoughts and views of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, who the show bears the name of.
That's good.
And find me on Twitter at Psyche68, C-Y-K-E-6-8.
Indeed. Todd, what about you? What you got going on out there? Where can people find you?
If you want to follow the boring musings of a middle-aged man on Twitter, I'm at Todd Weber Guitar. Everything is obsolete, out of date. You can also find me on an upcoming podcast with Russell Sellers, where we'll talk about Crisis on Infinite Earths. And I'm looking forward to being on that. That will happen later this month. Tell them more, Russell.
Yeah, good segue there. I thought you was just stealing my gimmick. But then I love popping Tim with my gimmick jokes, and that just happened. So, yeah, we're going to get into DC post-crisis management. That's coming up pretty soon. It's going to be a, as of now, scheduled 7-part series looking at the major crisis events from Crisis on Infinite Earths all the way through Heroes in Crisis, in which is currently scheduled to be bookended by the manager, Todd Weber. He's going to be at the beginning and the end of all that, and I'm sure that we'll be on a few other podcasts coming up in the near future. I also was on a part of the third biennial. I'm not even going to attempt the rest of that comic book draft with everyone else in the Sarcastic Four, part of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. So you can find me on that with picks that aren't really all that much better than Todd's. To tell you the truth, I am struggling, but we will get to the draft pitches sometime later, and you guys will have plenty of material to make fun of me there for. And then you can send all of your nasty negative thoughts to me, especially if you happen to be a Reed Richards lover. You can join Mike on Twitter and at me at Russell_Sellers, and I really hope there's some other Reed haters out there, though. I mean, you guys have got to back me up here. I'm getting a little tired of it. Not really. I'm going to keep hating on Reed forever. That's never going to get boring to me. But that's pretty much where you guys can find me. Of course, check out the Facebook group that we have, the Place to Be Nation Comics group, and follow the Place to Be Nation Comics Twitter. That's at PTBN Comics. And you'll be seeing more from pretty much everybody here. We'll be telling you about our upcoming shows, and then just talking comics. We love talking shop with folks, so join in all of that.
Hot take: I think Reed Richards hates himself as much as
Dr. Doom hates Reed Richards.
That is probably true. I can't dispute it.
It's a lot for us to consider.
Tis.
Indeed it is. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we hope you have enjoyed what you've heard. We hope you will join us next time on the Marvel Age podcast. So for myself, for the Fantastic Four, my God, what a day it has been. What a weekend it has been in the life and times of one Nick Duke. So for the Sarcastic Four and myself, hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Join us next time. Enough said.